this second instalment of the discussion with Chris Knight. We're examining together various aspects of human evolution and the theories that have tried to explain it. We start with the discussion of the role of the aquatic environment, riversides, lakesides, seashores, in the evolution of humanity. The problems posed in explaining the rapid increase in human brain size and at the evolution of the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. One of the most intriguing points to come out of this, for me at least, is the idea that the starting point for the evolution of solidarity in human beings is above all the development of solidarity amongst the females. But that's all part of the discussion, and we leave you to discover it.
Now, notice you refer also to Elaine Morgan. I like your description of her as one of the most exuberant theorists of the Eve from water.
Yeah, I mean, she took it too far. You know, we're not dolphins, and to be fair to her, she didn't even suggest we were, really. But so the idea of us swimming around in the sea probably doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, we need an explanation for bipedalism. And the best one is that if you didn't get a bit bipedal, if you couldn't wade, you'd just blooming well drown, and the water lifts you up.
Mm.
And there's a lot of evidence, you know, even today, even with bonobos today, they wade along rivers. They're not hydrophobic, unlike common chimps. They've been seen wading across rivers. If you don't wade, your head's under the water, you drown.
Mm.
A little bit of the ability to swim would have been heavily selected, because our species evolved in sort of mixed waterside environment. We've probably been at an early stage sleeping in trees. Okay, you fall out the tree, you fall into the water. What are you going to do? You better swim, you know. So to me, it's blindingly obvious that we were inhabiting three ecozones: the trees, the ground, and the water. And then it starts to make a lot of sense. You can explain a lot of stuff. You can explain, you know, the subcutaneous fat up to a point, the hairlessness, the bipedalism. Obviously, you know, seafood is very good for you, which it still is. And then, of course, you've got my stuff about the moon. Well, obviously, if you're talking about tidal estuaries, you've got a huge, you know, amplifying effect of
the moon's rhythm offers.
Yeah. So I'm very proud of that chapter, The Shores of Eden. I think it's, the savanna theory, the dry, hot savanna theory, is gone. Nobody thinks it anymore. There's no evidence for it. It's known that humans evolved in a kind of mixed waterside environment. We're always moving around along lake shores and river, you know, riverine.
And in fact, that's borne out also by the out of Africa, out of Eden.
Yeah,
studies that have been done on DNA distribution
around
the world, and as far as one can see, human beings moved out
around the coastlines, and when they moved inland,
it was up rivers.
Of course, and tell me that they moved along these coastlines and couldn't swim. I mean, pull the other one; it's ridiculous. Of course they could. I mean, we can swim. Common chimps can't swim; they drown. They're hydrophobic; they panic in the water. Humans, obviously, we have to learn to swim, but then imagine imagine living on by the waterside, little babies; they'd quickly learn to swim.
Mm.
So. You look
at kids in water.
Of course, they love it. And I think this hostility to the naked ape theory is just one more example of this bizarre fear of anything wet, anything female, anything possibly lunar. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just the same thing which makes people think in terms of man the hunter, man the toolmaker, man the whatever it is, you know, thinker and all that stuff. And then keep it all dry and don't be wet, you know, don't be feminine, don't be... It's this idiotic ideology.
It reminds me of my son's first bath. So when he was a very small baby, and I mean, the first bath you give the baby. And he was scared out of his wits and howling his head off as he lowered into the water. And as soon as he actually felt himself in the water...
Yeah. Suddenly relaxed.
A radical change. Not only relaxed, you think, water? This stuff is fantastic. You know, this is wonderful stuff.
Well,
I was soaked to the end of it.
My grandkids were born in water, water births. You know, much lovely way of being born. You come out of the womb and you're still not even born yet. You're the birth. It's like when you lift the baby out to the surface and they take their first breath. And it's just well known that babies more or less float. They've got so much fat on them when they're very little. And then if we just pop them in the water, they swim. You know, they know how to control their breath from a very early age. Again, I mean, I don't know. The idea of all that's coincidence seems to me ridiculous because it doesn't apply to common chimps. You know, they panic, they drown. Humans don't panic, they don't drown at that early age. Mm. So,
or to baboons. And I was reminded, I read Seaforth and Charney's book.
Seaforth and Charney.
That was fascinating. I really enjoyed it, apart from anything else, because it was such.
Was this How Monkeys See the World?
It was what's it called? The Philosophy of Baboons.
I see.
Something
okay.
like those. And for a start, I found it's a very admirable, deep study. I mean, they went back to the same place for 20 years, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Amboseli National Park.
And just in relation to what you've been talking about, one bit that stuck in my mind was a description of baboons crossing a water.
Yeah.
That women, female baboons, lose their children because the children hang on underneath, and the females do not have, they can't project themselves into the baby. So the baby drowns hanging underneath its mother because the mother, you know, the mother thinks, well, I've got my head above water. So presumably the baby's got its head above water as well.
I didn't know that.
One of my memories from the book. You know, so.
Oh, God.
Right. The other question about water, though, is that I remember Elaine, if I remember rightly, Elaine Morgan was saying, well, you know, if you were a chimp out on the, or proto-human ape out on the savannah, and you saw a tiger, where would you go? Up a tree? Bad idea. Into the water? Much more sense. And then I thought, hang on a minute.
Crocodiles. I remember lots of the opponents of the Karate Gate Theory just said that. Ah, crocodiles. As if Duff said, well, you know, you can see the crocodiles. You don't have to go there. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you might as well say, anywhere in the savannah. Well, oh, can't go there because it's like hyenas and lions and stuff.
Well, yes, exactly, yes.
I mean, just be sensible. I mean, you're not going to be unaware of the crocodiles, and you won't go in if there are any crocodiles. And then anyway, you may just have to take the risk. You know, otherwise it's either drowning or being eaten by a crocodile or both. I don't know. It's just like, but swimming is obviously better than not being able to swim, whether there's crocodiles or not.
Yes, clearly. at least if you can swim, there's a chance that if the crocodile's not around, you'll survive. It's another thing I find very... I always have difficulty with this because I'm hopeless with time and dates. And my calendar is very, very bad. You know,
you mean in terms of the evolution?
Just in terms of my own personal life. I'm very bad at remembering dates, which is pretty awful for a historian, really. But I usually try and think, well, if I can get things in the right order, then that's about as much as I hope to do. So I have great difficulty in keeping a grip on the timescales of all these things. And one thing that is... that always has perplexed me is the evolution of the brain.
Right.
What was the advantage we got out of the evolution of the brain? What's the story you get to explain that? It's one of the most expensive organs in the human body,
as you make the point. Exactly.
And it makes life very difficult for evolving humans. And if I've read you correctly, one of the points you make is that it's precisely the encephalization of the human baby, which obliges the females to oblige the men to help with that. And that gives me a problem with the time scale, because obviously if you're saying it's 150,000 years ago that this revolution happens, then the encephalization is happening over a much longer period.
A much earlier period, yeah.
So why is this revolution a revolution? Why doesn't it happen gradually? How do we explain what happened up to then?
Well,
so to speak?
Even just if you just look at the increase in brain size, to be honest, on a geological time scale,
it's very quick.
It's absolutely astonishingly quick. It's a huge leap. I mean, you know, you have about chimpanzees with maybe 350 cc brain size. So presumably, early Australopithecines would have had about 350 to 400 cc brain size, and that's going really right far back. That's going back for maybe 5 million years.
It's a bit like comparing motorbikes, isn't it?
That's right. And then you got maybe the earliest tools. I don't know, a little bit over 2 million years ago. You're getting what's called Homo habilis, kind of 800, you know, 800 cc's or something like that, or maybe a little bit more. And then you get into Homo erectus. And you have this what's often called a million years of boredom. And in that period, simply because nothing much was happening, you just had Homo erectus with hand axes, and they seemed to be very effective instruments, and they just only seemed to need one tool, this thing called a hand axe. And the brain size seemed, up to about 500,000 years ago, was, I don't know, 900 to, I don't know, a little bit more than 900,000 or something. And then the last half million years, you get this absolutely extraordinary, almost exponential increase in brain size. Like it goes off the chart. So given that brains are so right up to what it is now, and in, you know, it can be anything up to 1600 or even more, you know, and by the way, Neanderthals had even slightly bigger brains than we did. So given that the main restraint is this, the cost of these things, I mean, brains are just massively costly. They're obstetric costs, they kill you in childbirth. Thermoregulatory costs, it's really hard to keep the cooling system, especially in Africa. And above all, as you've said yourself, the metabolic costs. When you see this last 500,000 years, it's just like someone's taking the lid off the costs. It's like, feel free, don't worry about costs, no expense spared, just go for it. So clearly, I mean, normally you'd expect, you know, the cost to be paid by the female. The female's the one that has to, like, you know, go through the pregnancy. Obviously, with larger brain size, it's a longer pregnancy. Much, you know, you may have to give birth to them a bit prematurely because, you know, and then you've got to look after them. They're very vulnerable and, you know, need to go on carrying around, and they need special food, all that stuff. So the theory we have now pretty much is, well, first of all, it's like Sarah Hurdy's thing, mothers and others. So, okay, the evolving human female would have needed some help in childcare to offset the massive costs of this increasingly large brain. So the theory we have that the first she would have turned to would have been her mother. So the children would have had their granny looking after them, as well as their mum. That then explains the menopause. Why did the human female shut down her reproduction, you know, in a way quite early? I mean, she might live till 70 or 80, but she shuts down about, you know, 40s. Very good explanation. If you have your own children and you die there, you know, they'll die. If you have your daughter's children and invest in them, you know, you'll be transmitting your genes, but on the other hand, it won't be a disaster if you go. They've still got their mum. So that explains the menopause. So we're simply saying that the evolving human female turned first to a mother, then in addition to a mother, she turned to other females and got, like, collective parenting, sharing childcare, and only finally did she turn to the, whilst at the same time keeping the alliance with her mum, living with her mum, of course, and you know, sisters and aunts and cousins and so on, did she finally manage to start extracting some provisioning and help and investment and time and energy from the male of the species. So the getting stuff from the male of the species was the final revolutionary development, which required going on sex strike, because you're now needing to get the males to go away for quite a period of time, not think about sex, you know, in the absence of sex, you know, get their act together, be collaborative, and so on and so forth. So the underlying reason, the underlying selection pressure for large brains, we all take a very conservative view. It's just the basic social intelligence theory. It's just that the novel parts of the brain, the frontal lobes, the neocortex, is largely concerned with inhibition, being careful, you know, social intelligence, you know, working out things like the enemy of your enemy is your friend and stuff. So the argument is very simple. Evolving humans, right back to, I don't know, 3 or 4 million years ago, were increasingly living out in the savannah, or at least moving into the savannah, needing safety in numbers from predators. Living in a large group has got benefits, but also got huge costs in terms of conflicts and harassment and scarcity and stuff within the group. And you need your allies to avoid harassment. You need to therefore have memory. Remember who your allies are. Make sure you punish. When you punish people, you're punishing your enemies and not your friends, and you're rewarding your friends and not your enemies. All that social intelligence stuff was putting in pressure for large brains. But that doesn't explain the large brains. The actual production of the large brains can only be explained by the capacity to produce them. So we have a sort of generalized pressure for social intelligence given large group size, but then we have to say, given there was a kind of need for large brains, or rather, just given that females are going to produce a variety of offspring, some with larger brains than others, why would producing a baby with a larger brain, given that it's going to cost you more, why would that why would that, you know, enhance your fitness? And the answer is it would only enhance your fitness if you, as a mother, can offset some of the costs, either by living with your mother or by getting help from some other females, or finally, by, you know, exploiting this previously untapped resource, the spare capacity of the leisured sex, the male.
Why, for example, why have other? I confess, I find it hard to be convinced about by the social intelligence idea, and I've come across it again. Yeah. And I'm an interested amateur. I don't have an expert knowledge, but and I've seen. I'm a big fan of David Attenborough's films of the planet and nature and so on. And I remember one of his things is about a particular baboon which lives on cliffs. Exactly. Wonderful. Because they live on the cliffs because that's where the predators can't get. But they live in very big groups.
Well, Robin Dunbar, my friend Robin Dunbar, studied those very closely for many years.
So if they live in, were human groups even bigger than that? Do we need? If the baboon, what I'm saying is, if the baboons can manage it without becoming super intelligent baboons, why did we need to become super intelligent in order to live in big groups? Surely there must be something more to it. And I was, for example, if I go back to Jerome Lewis's thing about the pygmies, one of the things that struck me about that was his description of hunting and the fact that hunting is possible for the pygmies because they're able to think the way the animal thinks. But of course, that doesn't fit in with your theory, because if I take that as a reason for the encephalization, the problem with that is that we wouldn't have gone out to hunt until we had already got the big brains. And so I'm finding this very hard to fit together. But as I say, the social intelligence theory, I sort of look at it and I think, well, yes, but there are other animals that live in big groups. Why don't they get like that?
I think the sleeping groups, the groups when they all nest, you know, on the cliff face, are very big. I don't think they're anywhere near as big when they're out foraging. You know, how much of an argument that is, I'm not sure. I mean, Robin Dunbar's argument is that you have this need to keep together your allies by grooming them. It's quite costly to groom them, and the more allies you have, the more, you know, the more kind of energy you've got to put into this grooming. I don't think this very large hamadryas baboon troop that have, you know, got together for the night, I don't think each baboon needs to groom each other one or think of the others as allies. I don't think they're allies at all, actually. I don't think that's quite what we mean by group size. Means the network of others that you can rely on in some way as allies.
But that implies that you need allies for something.
It certainly does, and I think the argument would be that you probably need allies initially against others of your own species. You know, another rival group who might displace you from a good place that's got nice resources or. And so on. So there would have been probably quite another group-on-group conflict. There's no reason to assume otherwise. I mean, you know, there is with chimps and other primates. It's silly to think that humans would have been much different. And living in a fairly large group of allies you can really trust would have probably been a benefit. And if you're in a very small group, you might get beaten up by the enemy, you know. So I would have thought that kind of thing must have been going on. In the period prior to the human revolution, I think the human revolution would have made a really different situation, completely different cross-cutting alliances and ties and chains of connection. But before that, I would have thought a certain amount of violence, maybe even cannibalism, why rule it out? I don't know. And living in a large group of people you can trust, and then as soon as you assume that, you then think, right, how do you service these people? How do you keep them all happy? How do you, and you've been making mistakes. Good, but I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert on that really. I mean, I just being a little bit lazy, maybe. I, with my team, you know, in the Radical Anthropology Group, we've more or less gone along with the social intelligence theory, just in the sense that if you've only got two theories, and you've got the technical intelligence theory versus the social intelligence theory, it seems to me a no-brainer. I mean, you know, nuts, berries, and other animals nowhere near as cognitively challenging as another individual of your own species. That is really, you know, outwitting your own species, either outwitting them or securing their, you know, their commitment to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, you know, given the enormous amount of intelligence involved here, is a challenge, a massive challenge compared with cracking a nut or some damn thing or making a tool.
Well, that sort of suggests that there are two.